We'd like to thank JPMorgan Chase for their support to make this podcast happen. The views and opinions expressed in the podcast and the guests on the podcasts do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of JPMorgan Chase & Company or its affiliates. I'd like to welcome you to Commonwealth's Emerging Tech and Ideas podcast, a show on how emerging technology is impacting people living on low and moderate incomes. I'm Tim Flacca, Executive Director of Commonwealth and host of today's podcast. In each episode, we'll introduce you to a financial services leader who's innovating and thinking deeply on this topic. So thanks again for tuning in. Today's guest is Karen Kashyap, CEO and co-founder of Posh.ai. Karen attended MIT for both his undergraduate and graduate degrees, focused on artificial intelligence, where he was named a Siebel Scholar for his research work. And if you're not familiar with Posh, it's a company developing conversational AI-led virtual assistants specifically for banking. What differentiates Posh is that it's purpose-made for the specific kinds of conversations that we have when we're banking. And as they say, their product is where empathy is as essential as data and information. This is especially important and true for people earning low and moderate incomes. So let's jump in. Thank you for joining us today, Karen.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Excellent. Excellent. I just want us to start with a little bit of your background. How did you get into this field and why did you create Posh? Help us know where you're coming from.
Yeah, sure thing. You know, I think if you look at the landscape of companies that have been formed in the banking vertical or credit union verticals, it's often people that have come from the banking or credit union space and they have an idea and they start a company. In our case, you know, my co-founder and I were really coming from the AI world and we saw an opportunity to do something in banking. So, you know, we kind of joked that we're AI people starting a banking company as opposed to sometimes banking people trying to start, you know, X or Y company. But the journey of the business, we were actually grad students at MIT. So I've known my co-founder, Matt, he's our CTO, for about 10 years now. We were both actually undergrads together at MIT doing computer science. We actually ended up rushing the same fraternity. So we were fraternity brothers. Quickly became really good friends. And throughout our time at MIT, both in undergrad and grad school, we kind of knew we'd start a company together. We just didn't know exactly what it would be. We didn't necessarily have like an immediate idea that came to mind. But we knew we were both interested in the fields of natural language understanding. And we really believed that the future of human-computer interaction would be, you know, conversational interfaces and virtual assistant type interfaces. So we ended up joining a research lab at MIT that was really working on kind of the technology behind virtual assistants. So things like natural language understanding, speech recognition, deep learning, they were, you know, all over kind of the early onset of large language models and things like that. So we ended up becoming, you know, fairly decent experts in that field. We started doing consulting work with other companies while we were at school. And kind of the big aha moment for us in starting Posh was actually seeing Bank of America roll out their Erica product. That was pretty, you know, interesting because we saw that, hey, there's this really large bank that's able to hire all these people. And we know now that they've spent over $200 million in R&D for Erica so far. It was an aha moment because I've been a member of MIT Federal Credit Union since probably my first week I stepped on campus back in freshman year. So it was like, okay, if Bank of America is able to do something like Erica with all these resources, what about everybody else, right? And it kind of became our mission at that point to say, hey, we're going to start this company that's going to kind of democratize this idea of Erica. We're going to build conversational assistants and we're not going to go start by selling it to Bank of America like banks. We're actually going to start by selling it to the community financial institutions that are around, you know, corners of streets and stuff that we're walking by around Boston as well.
I love that part. The idea that, you know, this was really from your real experience, right? That you saw this opportunity. And, you know, for those of us that work in this field, credit unions have always occupied a certain special place. So that's a wonderful, wonderful origin story. Let's just go a little bit deeper as you got into it, and maybe the contrast with Erica is useful here. Where did you see the particular opportunity for the things, if I understand, you and your co-founder had spent a lot of time and energy, you know, getting smart about and experimenting with? Where were the deeper connection points that you were excited to explore through creating Posh?
Yeah. And, you know, we're not the first kids on the block with this idea. There have been companies that have tried to do what, you know, Posh has been doing. Some of them are still around today, but we came into the market really around 2019. So 2018, we came out of our lab. For about a year, it was building, not really going out there and talking about it too much, you know, kind of staying under the radar a bit. We were working through this accelerator program that MIT runs every summer that helps startups that are founded by students actually become real companies. So we had some of those kind of supporting infrastructures in Boston, which is great. We were also part of the DCU FinTech Innovation Center cohort run by Digital Credit Union. That was really helpful as well. But yeah, some companies have been around since like 2012, 2013 in our space. And I think one of the things that we noticed, even with Erica itself at some of these companies, is that a lot of people were focused on the digital channel. So things like digital banking or website chat. But the more we talked to credit unions and the more we kind of understood where their pain was, we realized that, hey, digital is a nice to have, but the voice channel, AKA the call center or phone calls, is where the pain really is. A lot of the credit unions we were speaking to didn't really have live chat products, or even if they did, they didn't really staff it too much. So they weren't really considering that a primary service channel. Whereas pretty much everybody we talked to had call centers and they wished they had more people there and they were not able to offer 24/7 support and things like that. So, you know, we kind of looked at, you know, where we could actually add a lot of value. And pretty early on, we decided to not only focus on the digital channel, like an Erica or like some of the competitors that we saw, but we pretty early on said, let's build a voice interface as well and build an actual product that integrates with the call center and the phone systems of these credit unions and banks. I think that was like a pretty big differentiator for us. And it allowed us to actually use some of that background that we had from our research lab work as well, and speech recognition and the audio side of the tech stack as well. So, you know, we think like that was pretty smart move in a sense, because we also launched our first customers right before COVID. And when COVID hit, a lot of branches shut down. So call volumes went up even more. People that used to go into branches couldn't anymore. So instead they were picking up the phones and calling in. So, you know, we were able to bring a voice product into market, I think at a good time, shortly before COVID. So we had case studies and some successful deployments that we could go give confidence to people that were looking at ways to use AI to mitigate some of those challenges.
Karen, I love that point, because I feel as if voice is often overlooked. And I think many of us, either from our own experience or from, you know, maybe parents or grandparents, we have this idea of people who struggle to access technology. And when I picture that person, or the moments when I have been that person as I get older, you know, it feels like voice is a more intuitive, more accessible technology interface. Is that been your experience? Is my intuition been borne out by what you've seen?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a lot of like habit forming in a sense, right? Like people who have made habits of calling into their credit union, it's really difficult to get them to say, hey, you know what, from now on, you're actually going to go to our website and chat with this little chatbot on the corner. And that's what you're going to do, right? So as much as I think a lot of credit unions and banks are really excited about channel deflection and getting more digital adoption, and that's naturally starting to happen too. Like, don't get me wrong, I think with things like ChatGPT, and I think this might be the first time you've said that in the podcast, probably not the last, but with things like ChatGPT, that is getting people more comfortable with the idea of interacting with a more human-like assistant on a digital channel. But like you said, you know, a lot of people have just formed habits to pick up the phone and call, and that's honestly where credit unions have put most of their staff historically as well. So being where the source of the pain is, so to speak, right? Being where the real volume is was pretty good for us to actually get traction with credit unions and also deliver real ROI.
That makes sense. And it's not just the technology, but how it interacts with the people is sort of what I hear there too. Mm-hmm. I want to switch gears a little bit. Something that we spend a lot of time thinking about at Commonwealth is, you know, really checking ourselves that whatever we're working on is adding up to the handful of outcomes that we really care about. And for us, that's, you know, one of those key outcomes is greater financial security for families who often don't have it. And I want to see if you can help us understand how the things that Posh is working on, you know, that you already have deployed, and maybe some of the things that you can see in the distance, can help achieve or contribute to that outcome for families of having more financial security.
Yeah, definitely. A lot of it is also just, you know, getting people access to banking services that maybe they couldn't have really strong access to before. A good example of that is someone that's not working typical hours. Maybe they can't really get into a branch during normal branch hours, or they can't call a call center during normal call center operating hours. How do we extend the ability for a community financial institution to actually serve those members or customers at a time that works for them? And I think that's where AI gets really interesting, right? You know, there's this a good way to kind of frame what I think is the future of AI, which is a bank or credit union that has, you know, 100,000 users or a million users. they don't have 100,000 or a million support agents, right? Every business in the world, not just banks or credit unions, would love to have a one-to-one ratio of support agents to customers. Imagine if you were a support agent that could literally follow your customer around everywhere, look at everything they're doing, taking copious notes, and then offering really great personalized service to that individual. That's impossible to do because maybe there aren't enough people that could even fill that role and also be super expensive. But Sam Altman from OpenAI said something really interesting, which is AI is doing something really interesting in the world, which is it's reducing the cost of intelligence, right? And that's really what AI is doing over time. The smarter the AI gets, the incremental cost of intelligence gets cheaper and cheaper, just like we saw the incremental cost of compute maybe getting cheaper and cheaper with like the advent of cloud infrastructure, right? And what we can start doing with intelligence getting cheaper is we can now afford to do more of these things like really personalized service or someone that's running around and taking copious notes for every single person that were not possible with pure human labor, right? And I think there's a really awesome opportunity to now leverage the staff that you have, the human beings that are working for your organization, and turbocharge them a bit with the power of AI. And things that we're doing at Posh to kind of do this is, you know, how do we take away kind of the boring routine stuff away from the call center agents and the branch tellers that one tend to clog up the queues in the first place? So why do we call into a bank and have a long hold time? It's because they're helping other people. But a lot of the people they're helping are things that maybe don't require an actual person to help them do, like a routing number or what's their balance or did my check actually deposit. You want humans to be there for the really challenging topics or the things that require relationship building and empathy, like you mentioned, things that require creative problem solving. And that's what people get excited about too. Like there's a challenge with attrition in call centers. And I think a lot of that is because the job isn't maybe the most fun today, right? So how do we make the job more impactful, more interesting, more challenging? And if we can actually make the economics work, making the call center agents not just focused on wrapping up the call as quickly as possible to get to the next one, but giving them the freedom to actually build relationships and actually drive revenue growth and top line impact, maybe we can actually afford to uplift that job as a whole as well, right? So I think the AI potential is not just from the perspective of the end user, the customer. I mean, that's really important. Financial wellness, financial security, these are all things that can be partially served by AI, but can be even more served by the human agents and financial services experts that banks and credit unions have. So a lot of it is also how do we empower the humans to really unlock their own potential by letting AI kind of act as a personal assistant to them in a sense as well, but also freeing them up to really unlock the real value of the time and expertise that they have. Another thing that we're doing at Posh towards that is we have a new product that we launched called Knowledge Assistant, which ties into all of the policies, procedures, and SOPs of a bank or credit union. So imagine if you're a new hire in the call center, new hire in the bank branch, or you're coming in as a loan officer. Typically, these roles are pretty hard to find and hire somebody, but training can also take a long time. But what we want to do is instead of having people put customers on hold or callers on hold and go spend multiple minutes looking up documentation, find an answer, let the AI kind of do that. Let the AI ingest all the knowledge and just give you the right answer really quickly so that now you're able to answer the question faster. You're spending a lot less time per call. And again, we're freeing you up to really build relationships and focus on the next thing besides just wrapping up the call and getting to the next one.
There's so much there that you said that really resonates. I'm thinking about, we've probably all read some version of this, but one of the potentials of generative AI is this, you know, vision that every student might have their own personalized tutor. And I hear total echoes of that in the way you're thinking about. And what I hear and I really love is that on the supply side, there's an opportunity for financial service providers to allow their existing teams to do the higher level stuff. You didn't say this, but I assume that you believe that leads to stickier customer relationships, more satisfied customers. And I just have to share a quick anecdote. I was trying to put together a piece of furniture over the weekend, you know, think the stores with the lots of instructions. And, you know, of course I got to a point where it wasn't coming together right. And the instructions had an 800 number and I almost didn't call because I expected to encounter, you know, your worst version of the automated tree and so on. And to my delight, a human being answered, and she was right there in it. She said, "Nah, I think you need to go to step 6. Well, hold on. Let me talk to my engineer." And she went and she came back and they said, "If you loosen screw 7 and you move it to the right, you'll get a better," you know, and I was like blown away. So I hear in your description, imagine if more experiences like that, when you call into your financial service provider, exceed your expectations about the degree of rolling up their sleeves. That's great. Well, we've already touched on this a little bit, but I want to return really to this question of usage, right? Because in many ways, unlocking the outcomes we care about hinges on you know, customers and potential customers using the technologies. And, you know, we at Commonwealth are thinking about and focused on low and moderate income families. We know in this country, that means you're more likely to be Black, you're more likely to be Latin, households are more likely to be women led. And, you know, there's some sort of realities that are relevant to this question of usage. You know, one is that low and moderate income populations are actually more likely to rely on smartphones to access and use banking services. And our own research found they're more likely, at least through the pandemic, we saw a 200% increase in use of chatbots. But on the other hand, there's also ample evidence, and for very understandable reasons, there's much deeper mistrust of mainstream financial institutions and industry in these same populations. So when you wrestle with all of that, you know, what do you see are the trends that are going to drive usage specifically for the populations that we're thinking about?
Yeah, and you know, it's not just service in English a lot of the times, right? It's other languages, and then bringing banking services to populations that, you know, don't speak mainstream English. So, you know, one thing that's really exciting is that things like large language models, new innovations, are really good at bringing multilingual capabilities. And in the past, you know, a lot of people that have tried to do multilingual and virtual assistant technology have just kind of relied on a service like Google Translate. So you know, basically build your assistant in English and you kind of use Translate as an intermediary. The problem with things like Google Translate is that they're not built for financial services. So certain things don't get translated the right way. You know, it's like kind of choppy translations from a financial services lens. And things like LLMs are really interesting because you can actually train these models to be LLMs for this vertical, or you can fine tune them to be LLMs for financial services. And those multilingual capabilities tend to be a lot better than a service that's not built for the domain or for the vertical. So things like vertical SaaS or vertical AI, like these are all really big areas of focus for venture capitalists, for example, because they know the future of a lot of these technologies like AI is going to be vertical heavy and vertical focused for those reasons. One thing I want to talk about too is I know maybe a lot of the population may not trust like the really large kind of behemoth organizations, but there are a ton of really small, often overlooked by vendors, credit unions, and banks around the country, right? You have a lot of really, in the grand scheme, kind of pretty small, like we call them small market credit unions and banks. These are the ones that tend to also really have presence in areas that are not really large urban cities on the coasts. So if you go through, you know, sort of the central part of the country, you may not see the biggest banks having big presences there, but you will see a lot of, you know, kind of cooperatives and credit unions that have kind of spawned based on the town or based on the category of workers that tends to be there. So in the past, if you look at, you know, a lot of these like smaller credit unions and banks, think like 10, 50, even, you know, maybe even 100 million in assets, but definitely sub 100 million assets, it gets even worse. A lot of vendors in the past, technology vendors, and Posh included in a sense historically, we've often overlooked that part of the market just because the cost to serve that market has been maybe not great from a business standpoint, right? So for building a virtual assistant historically, you need to have a conversational design partner. We have human beings that we've hired who have conversational design certifications. You have to have some level of customization of your model per institution, and that requires often some human in the loop in the machine learning components. So there was a little bit of a challenge for us historically, and even for other companies. You look at like digital banking vendors and core vendors, sometimes you see the biggest players won't really touch some of these smaller institutions. What that leads to is sort of a technology desert, so to speak, for that part of the market, and especially for the areas of the country where that's really the types of FIs that are kind of really playing there. So what I really am interested in too and excited about is that Posh is trying to do better in this area as well. And it's not because, you know, we never really cared. It's just because the cost to serve was not really feasible for us in the past. But that's where things like generative AI and LLMs really become interesting, because where we used to require humans to, say, parse through dozens of knowledge articles and go through their policies, procedures, and training manuals to extract the information we needed to actually build our virtual assistant, more and more we can start relying on AI tools to actually do some of that heavy lifting and make these technologies accessible to even those types of financial institutions as well. And I think what that will result in is, you know, if we can offer and empower these solutions to those types of FIs, now we're able to, again, bring more technology to the service or to the communities that they serve, right? And in the past, like, you know, we started the company Posh because we didn't think that the best technology was exclusive only to the Bank of America's. We wanted to bring it to the mid-market. well, the best technology shouldn't also only be accessible to the mid-market, it should also be available to the small markets as well. So it's this like increasing waterfall of like bringing better technologies down market, which is only enabled by improving things like cost to serve. And like we talked about a second ago, the diminishing cost of intelligence over time.
It's a really interesting kind of thesis there that in this use case, increasing efficiency and reduction in cost actually can accrue to the smaller players. That's something probably worthy of a whole conversation unto itself. I did want to ask you one follow-up, and this is, I'm hitting you without any preparation, so I know that, but you know, based on my own experience as a customer, I have a hypothesis that when you have one of these, the way you just described, better interactions where the person, if it is a person, is able to really give you more tailored, personalized, you know, you really feel seen kind of service. Is there any evidence that that leads to greater trust, greater customer satisfaction, all these kinds of metrics that we as business people would want to see? Is there data on that?
I don't know if we have data on that specifically, but I think that's, I'd agree with that. I don't know if I need the data to like agree with that. I think that makes sense. And if you think about it, like many businesses have been very successful in the past by focusing on delivering great service. If you read, you know, there's the restaurateur Danny Meyer, right? Well, famous for a lot of Michelin restaurants. He's one of the most famous restaurateurs in New York. He talks about the difference between service and hospitality. And he said, service is what you expect a services provider to do for you. Like you walk into a restaurant, you expect certain things, that's good service. Hospitality is how they make you feel, right? And he argues that like hospitality is what separates the best restaurants from, you know, maybe the good restaurants, right? It's not often like who has the best food or who has the best decor. It's like the restaurants you really come back to and you say, that was fantastic. Yeah, they have to have baseline qualities of, you know, good food and decor and stuff, but really, it's the hospitality, I think, that separates a lot of these restaurants from others. And he argues that in one of his books as well. But that was really interesting to me, like this idea that like service is what you're expecting and hospitality is kind of going above and beyond. And it's how they make you feel, how you come away feeling afterwards. I think that's pretty powerful. And I don't know if that's backed by data, but it certainly worked for Danny Meyer.
Well, I love that. That distinction really makes sense to me. And I would sort of add on to it to say, you know, tell me if you agree, but I think often we associate that hospitality end of the spectrum with luxury and something that people with higher incomes and more money to spend, you know, are entitled to expect in their hospitality, you know, their hotel experience or their dining experience. But it's a pretty interesting thought to imagine that this technology can extend that hospitality end of the spectrum to a whole additional market. So I really love that. That's super interesting. I want to switch gears again a little bit, although, you know, the conversation obviously is interwoven. So some of this we've touched on, but one of the things that I felt in thinking about the power and potential of AI, you know, and especially now generative AI, is this tension between the things that are right in, you know, in front of us or right over the horizon and yet the knowledge, and plenty of people have written about this, that there are these bigger changes, bigger possibilities. And it's hard sometimes to both live in the space of what does this mean next year and what does this mean further out? And I wonder if we map that basic question to financial services, you know, what are you excited about that's beyond just increasing the quality of customer interactions that you see potential for AI, either in, you know, inside Pasta Shop or frankly, more broadly as well? Things like core institutional functions that might, you know, be the way that we get to these efficiencies you're already alluding to, or entirely new applications of technology in financial services that we might not even really be thinking about today, sort of paradigm changing. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, definitely. And it's really, by the way, it's really hard to like forecast timeframes. I think we as humans don't do a great job of understanding exponential things, right? It's really difficult for us to like really wrap our heads around those things. But that's really where we are, I think, with AI. Like we're still in the early eras, early innings of AI, but I think it really is going to be an exponential journey. And in a way, it's a little scary because even myself running an AI business, like it's hard for me to forecast exactly what's going to happen or when. But you know, what I think is really exciting about what we will see is, even if you think about businesses like Posh or just how we think about support in general, it tends to be associated with a lot of like reactive behavior, right? You're not really trying to preempt the solution with the customer. You're kind of waiting for them to pick up the phone and call you, and they have a problem, and then you can solve it. And you know, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of value there right now to, like, you know, get better and better at AI solving those routine things that people call. But what it misses is some level of, like, proactiveness or some level of predictiveness, right? And I think one of the challenges is in getting to this vision is that banks and credit unions tend to have pretty, like, fragmented customer data platforms. So you might have, like, some information living in a core, some information living in a card processing system, others in an LOS, others in a CRM, and so forth. For AI to get really good at being proactive and predictive, you kind of need to unify that customer data platform, if you will, right? You need to be able to use as much data as you have on a customer to really serve them well. It's not just like, what's your favorite color or what size of shoe did you order last time? It's like, you know, other really meaningful things. And with financial services, like, you can go a lot deeper because a lot of the reasons why people behave certain ways and live their lives is financial reasons, right? And how they spend their money, where they spend their money, what their goals are in life, where they live, how old they are, like, all these are, like, pretty interesting characteristics to really start to understand where someone is in their journey and maybe start to be a little bit more proactive with that, right? And that's a goal that we have at Posh. Like, I don't know if we'll like, you know, get there in the next 12 months. I don't think so. I think it's like a multi-year vision, but it's a flywheel that we form between understanding a user to then engage them better, right? The more you can engage a user, the more they engage back with you, the more data you end up collecting about them that allows you to engage them better. So in a sense, like, you have to have, like, a good enough performance for them to come back and use your product. But also you need to understand as much data as you can about them that you have, or maybe the bank has, to set yourselves up to have a really great first impression and offer them the best engagements that you can every time, right? And I like that notion of a flywheel, because even machine learning itself is a flywheel, right? You need data to train these models. In a sense, we need data to train our platform to best serve an individual customer in a personalized way, as opposed to treating a customer as one of many like them in a large customer base of a bank or credit union.
Love that. And it dovetails with something that I find myself thinking a lot, you know, again, both reflecting on my own life, but also thinking about our work at Commonwealth, which is, there are so many pressures that make us live in the financial present. And yet, you know, in theory, thinking about our entire lifetime as part of our financial decisions and so on, probably offers us a lot of benefits. And so there's something about your flywheel notion and the idea of leaning more into proactivity, if that's a word, rather than reactivity, that feels like it's the component parts of helping us to live with a longer time horizon, you know, in mind. So I love that a lot. Well, so we can't have this conversation without spending a minute on some of the concerns that we all read about and probably worry about related to AI. And one of them is, you know, what can go wrong? There's, of course, a lot of possible answers to that question. The one I want to ask you, though, is, are there ethical trade-offs just inherent in the development of AI? Like, do we give up something for what we gain? And if so, what are we giving up? And, you know, how do we think about this? How do we mitigate that? How do we navigate any trade-offs? What are your thoughts there?
Yeah. You know, I think when you think about, like, even just people using ChatGPT, they find issues with inaccuracies, sometimes biases. It really stems to what data was used to train those models, right? That's like a pretty simplistic realization, is that, yeah, you have these issues downstream with how the model's performing, but it probably goes back to the data that it was fed in the first place. With banking, of course, that's a bit more sensitive. If you think about, like, loan decisioning models, for example, like, you know, there's clear scary things that can happen if there's bias in those models, right? And not great for marginalized populations. So what I think is pretty important is, one, there's this notion of, like, model risk management that banks already employ when they're thinking about using machine learning models or AI models, even like, you know, kind of not the large ones that we see here today, but even just kind of smaller, more statistical models. There's this idea of model risk management where you keep this, what we call a gold corpus, or this, like, example set of, like, fake users, you know, just hypothetical users. And you run these models in this, like, sandbox environment and just make sure that it's performing the way you want. So you can create this data set however you want to, like, best represent your actual customer base, you know, have different kinds of users and profiles and things like that. So you can keep testing models as you improve, because the models will never be static, right? The goal with the machine learning model, any AI model, is you want to keep investing and improving it. So what can happen sometimes is, if models are iterated on, you might see improvement 90% of the time, but then you might see detraction the other 10% of the time. And it can be really bad if you are consistently detracting in an area a user population where it's impacting fairness and ethical outcomes, right? So what's really great about like this kind of model risk management approach that people use in the loan decisioning side already is that you can actually engineer this like gold corpus to make sure that you're covering your bases in a sense, right? You iterate on these models and you test the performance of these models on this gold corpus and say, okay, like I feel pretty confident that we're not trading off anything. Like we're not improving 90% to detract the 10% that's going to like cause bad financial outcomes for part of our customers. And it's really the onus of the organization or the business to make sure that they're taking that process seriously. And the same thing for like conversational AI or large language model applications, things that Pasha is touching. And we don't do like loan decisioning, by the way. I'm just using that as an example. On our side, we can kind of do the similar things. Like when we're iterating on our conversational models, we can have this like bank of thousands of sample conversations or sample inquiries and, you know, sample scenarios and stuff that we think well represent the things we will see in the wild, right? Edge cases, maybe different types of users, some that are more willing to talk to a bot, some that are more upset, you know, they're a little less willing to talk to a bot. And we can iterate on our models and actually run these models on our gold corpus and say, hey, you know, we feel pretty good. Like we're not like trading off something substantial. And sometimes trade-offs are part of life, right? You know, you have to like be willing sometimes to trade something off, but you can't cross ethical boundaries and you can't marginalize people as a result of these trade-offs, right? And that's why this type of approach is pretty valid. That you know, you can design a good gold corpus, whether it's fake people or fake conversations or whatever it is, and just run these simulations to make sure you feel confident. And the other thing I'll say too is again, like it's not just the testing, it's the training in the first place. Like we need to make sure the data we're training these models on is safe data and it's good data. And also be careful about where you're actually applying these AI models. A lot of these models are too big to serve on-premise. You know, they require dozens of machines and GPUs, if not hundreds. So running them in cloud compute clusters is pretty much the way to go. But of course, you know, sometimes banks have not really embraced the cloud yet, or they don't own the cloud infrastructure themselves, which I don't expect them to. But making sure that they're deploying these things in a secure way, such that malicious parties cannot come in and you know hijack a very ethically constructed a solution and inject some bad things into it, you know, I would recommend really being diligent on who you partner with, right? There's a lot of companies out there that are preaching AI stuff, but they weren't really AI companies in the past. They're leaning into the hype. There are other companies out there that have been AI companies for a long time, have the right people, have the expertise. So yeah, when things get hot and things get really popular, sometimes people will try to take advantage of that. And I think banks will do well by being diligent on who they partner with.
That all makes sense. The follow-up question, of course, that has to be asked, even though it may be tough to answer, is if data is, you know, getting that data right, is what I heard you say. We live in an imperfect world where the data we have available is incomplete, you know, sometimes for horrible reasons, systemic legacy of discrimination, sometimes for just accidental reasons. Any thoughts about what we, you know, how we live in that reality that today the amount of data, the quality of data, and frankly, on whom is just different, you know, by income and probably by race and gender and other issues?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a hard problem. I mean, like I talked about the flywheel, like you need to serve a certain population to get data that you can then use to serve them better, right? So if you're not able to even penetrate certain demographics or certain types of population, then it's really difficult to like have data, right? So, you know, it is something that you can get better at by just trying to solve them better, even without the AI side, right? Like just focus more on how do we like bring banking services to more of these populations. And then that actually helps you ultimately build AI models better, just like unifying your customer data will help you build, you know, more personalized AI experiences better as well. So one thing I will say is that, you know, a lot of the concerns around bias and stuff comes down to a couple of areas of AI. One is decisioning AI, like who do we give a loan to? The other is the generative side of AI. What is AI actually creating, right? It's a lot more risky if you use an AI model to generate things that didn't exist before. Like that's when inherent biases of these the training data can actually kind of surface. A lot of applications of large language models though is not just generative. Actually, a lot of people have been, you know, kind of saying, hey, Google's in, you know, danger a little bit, because LLMs are really good at understanding information as well, and they're really good at processing information. So use cases like search become really interesting with things like large language models. search is not generating anything. It's actually just organizing something, right? And you know, when you think about the potential risks of using generative models, like, oh, it's going to say something that's you know, not politically correct, or you're going to say something offensive, or it's going to say something or that's like not the best advice to give to a certain person or population. You end up like having to trust the model to generate things the right way. And I think that sometimes, like for customer facing use cases, that can be a little scarier. What's really interesting though, is that you can still use these large language models and generative AI technologies, but not do the generative stuff. Like you can have it just understand the context of interaction better, but then you can have a bit more of a logic driven way to respond to the user, right? So instead of giving it free reign to construct a response however it wants to, you give it templates, or you give it kind of some level of like predefined paths to follow, so that you feel a little bit better that you've actually had a human in the loop, an expert, to design these possible paths, and that you're avoiding like risk bias, these types of things. And the model is having to adhere to these as well. So you're leveraging the understanding side of the models without letting it like go crazy on the generative side, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think drawing that distinction between generative and maybe analytic or something, I'm not sure what the alternative seems really important. And the other point you made that I just want to call out, because I think it's interesting, I haven't heard it elsewhere. I'm putting words in your mouth a little bit, but you know, there is an argument to individuals or frankly communities who might be less likely to use AI technologies, that's perpetuating the lack of data and the problem. And you know, I personally wouldn't advocate that somebody make their decision just based on the altruism of trying to overcome a much larger systemic problem. But I think on the margins, there are lots of examples of people saying, I do want my actions to contribute to, you know, ameliorating this systemic problem. And I hadn't really considered that my choice to take a risk on this technology or be a little bit more open to it can make a positive contribution. So that's really interesting.
Yeah, I don't think you need the AI to actually generate the data all the time. Like AI might like help make that flywheel move faster. But when Posh first started, we didn't have data from AI. We had data from actual human interactions, right? So that's what we used to actually get off the ground. And I'd argue that sometimes that human interaction data might actually be more valuable, because it's more likely to be more diverse than the AI data. Like if AI is trained to follow certain paths, well, like all data you're going to get is going to be kind of defined in the same paths that you've already constructed. You want more edge case data. You want more data outside of the common path to actually help you understand where there's opportunities to further train or further build, right? And the combination of having AI source data, but also the human source data, I think that's actually pretty valuable.
That's actually a really great point, that it's further from the mainstream, maybe where it's most additive, right? Most marginal benefit. I love that. Well, we could talk a long time, but we're coming to the end of our time. So I want to just really hearty thank you, Karen, for making the time and for just offering the thoughts that you have. I am pretty sure that our audience has taken some good stuff away from this. Maybe there's one more chance for them to do that. Is there anything, you know, imagining we have a pretty wide cross-section of folks listening, but anything that you would recommend to read about AI, technology-related issues, or check out, maybe it's, you know, some other medium. Any recommendations there?
Yeah, I mean, I probably recommend some stuff, and then by the time people watch this, it'll be outdated because AI is going to move faster, right? No, I think it kind of depends on what you're looking to do. If you just want to understand AI better and kind of how it works, there's really great YouTube videos that kind of, you know, talk about it from different lenses. If you're looking to actually just get a feel for AI, go try it out, right? There's ChatGPT and Bing Chat and all these other like virtual chat experiences that are being powered by LLMs, and more companies are coming into the LLM space. By the way, like we talked about the diminishing cost of intelligence, like part of that is powered by the fact that there's more than just OpenAI playing in the space, right? And there's more competition happening at this LLM level. So one, it's driving people to keep pushing improvements, but it's also driving people to bring down costs, which helps downstream players like Posh actually build applications on top of it, because now the incremental cost of an API called a large language model becomes a lot cheaper over time, right? So that is really exciting. And these technologies, I think, are getting into services and products that we're using day to day by other big companies that we might not even notice. Like you open Amazon's landing page and you see all these products that are really personalized to you. That's a good example of companies that have like stealthily built personalization engines and AI models that maybe don't advertise it as such, right? But that's really what it is. I would recommend you know, just trying things out and playing around with ChatGPT, and hopefully as you try things out, like you'll ask questions as to like, hey, this was wrong, what's happening, what is a hallucination, how does this technology actually work, I got into computer science because I was actually playing, you know, computer games, and I wanted to learn how to build a computer game, and that kind of got me to that space. So I'm a big believer in doing, and then that drives you to learn because it builds curiosity.
And, you know, to your original point, it's sort of future proof, right? That engaging with the technology or whatever state it is always going to be of the moment, as opposed to trying to read something about it. Well, we're going to need to leave it there. I want to just thank you again and encourage all of our listeners to keep this conversation in mind the next time that they reach out to their financial service provider and find themselves interacting with either a human agent or a technology agent. Thank you so much.
Hopefully a human agent that's augmented with a technology agent maybe too, right? So
100%. Thanks again, Karen.
All right. Thanks so much.
All right.